soil of this new country with the heathen worship of these people. Much spoil can be made of selling the whole lot to Barbados, where slaves fetch good prices in rum and sugar, and we shall not only do the Lord great good by punishing the wicked, but we shall make great good for his minister and people. Yours in the bowels of Christ, Cotton Mather.
Once we have broken free of the prejudices of our own provincially limited ecclesiastical, tribal, or national rendition of the world archetypes, it becomes possible to understand that the supreme initiation is not that of the local motherly fathers, who then project aggression onto the neighbors for their own defense. The good news which the world Redeemer brings, and which so many have been glad to hear, zealous to preach, but reluctant, apparently, to demonstrate, is that God is love, that he can be and is to be loved, and that all without exception are his children. Such comparatively trivial matters as the remaining details of the credo, the techniques of worship, and devices of episcopal organization, which have so absorbed the interest of Occidental theologians that they are today seriously discussed as the principal questions of religion, are merely pedantic snares, unless kept ancillary to the major teaching. Indeed, where not so kept, they have a regressive effect. They reduce the father image back again to the dimensions of the totem. And this, of course, is what has happened throughout the Christian world. One would think that we had been called upon to decide or to know whom, of all of us, the Father prefers. Whereas the teaching is much less flattering. Judge not, that ye be not judged. The world Savior's cross, in spite of the behavior of its professed priests, is a vastly more democratic symbol than the local flag.
Dr. Carl Menninger has pointed out that though Jewish rabbis, Protestant ministers, and Catholic priests can sometimes be brought to reconcile, on a broad basis, their theoretical differences, yet, whenever they begin to describe the rules and regulations by which eternal life is to be achieved, they hopelessly differ. Up to this point, the program is impeccable, writes Dr. Menninger. But if no one knows for certain what the rules and regulations are, it all becomes an absurdity. The reply to this, of course, is that given by Ramakrishna. God has made different religions to suit different aspirants, times, and countries. All doctrines are only so many paths, but a path is by no means God himself. Indeed, one can reach God if one follows any of the paths with wholehearted devotion. One may eat a cake with icing, either straight or sidewise. It will taste sweet either way.
The understanding of the final and critical implications of the world redemptive words and symbols of the tradition of Christendom has been so disarranged during the tumultuous centuries that have elapsed since St. Augustine's declaration of the holy war of the Civitas Dei against the Civitas Diaboli, that the modern thinker, wishing to know the meaning of a world religion, i.e. of a doctrine of universal love, must turn his mind to the other great and much older universal communion, that of the Buddha, where the primary word still is peace. Peace to all beings.
I do not mention Islam, because there, too, the doctrine is preached in terms of the holy war, and thus obscured. It is certainly true that there, as well as here, many have known that the proper field of battle is not geographical, but psychological. Compare Rumi. What is beheading? Slaying the carnal soul in the holy war. Nevertheless, the popular and orthodox expression of both the Mohammedan and the Christian doctrines has been so ferocious that it requires a very sophisticated reading to discern in either mission the operation of love.
The following Tibetan verses, for example, from two hymns of the poet Saint Milarepa, were composed about the time that Pope Urban II was preaching the First Crusade.
Amid the city of illusoriness of the six world planes, the chief factor is the sin and obscuration born of evil works. Therein the being followeth dictates of likes and dislikes, and findeth ne'er the time to know equality. Avoid, O my son, likes and dislikes. If ye realize the emptiness of all things, compassion will arise within your hearts. If ye lose all differentiation between yourselves and others, fit to serve others ye will be. And when in serving others ye shall win success, then shall ye meet with me. And finding me, ye shall attain to Buddhahood.
The emptiness of all things, Sanskrit, shunyata, voidness, refers, on the one hand, to the illusory nature of the phenomenal world, and on the other, to the impropriety of attributing such qualities as we may know from our experience of the phenomenal world to the imperishable. In the heavenly radiance of the voidness, there existeth not shadow of thing or concept, yet it pervadeth all objects of knowledge, obeisance to the immutable voidness.
Peace is at the heart of all, because Avalokiteshvara, Kuan Yin, the mighty Bodhisattva, boundless love, includes, regards, and dwells within, without exception, every sentient being. The perfection of the delicate wings of an insect, broken in the passage of time, he regards, and he himself is both their perfection and their disintegration. The perennial agony of man, self-torturing, deluded, tangled in the net of his own tenuous delirium, frustrated, yet having within himself, undiscovered, absolutely unutilized, the secret of release, this too he regards and is. Serene above man, the angels. Below man, the demons and unhappy dead. These all are drawn to the Bodhisattva by the rays of his jewel hands, and they are he, as he is they. The bounded, shackled centers of consciousness, myriad-fold, on every plane of existence, not only in this present universe, limited by the Milky Way, but beyond, into the reaches of space, galaxy beyond galaxy, world beyond world of universes, coming into being out of the timeless pool of the void, bursting into life, and like a bubble therewith vanishing, time and time again, lives by the multitude, all suffering, each bounded in the tenuous, tight circle of itself, lashing, killing, hating, and desiring peace beyond victory. These all are the children, the mad figures of the transitory yet inexhaustible long-world dream of the all-regarding, whose essence is the essence of emptiness. The Lord looking down in pity. But the name means also the Lord who is seen within. Avalokita, Sanskrit, equals looking down, but also seen. Ishvara equals Lord. Hence both the Lord looking down in pity and the Lord seen within. We are all reflexes of the image of the Bodhisattva. The sufferer within us is that divine being. We and that protecting Father are one. This is the redeeming insight. That protecting Father is every man we meet. And so it must be known that, though this ignorant, limited, self-defending, suffering body may regard itself as threatened by some other, the enemy, that one too is the God. The ogre breaks us, but the hero, the fit candidate, undergoes the initiation, like a man. And behold, it was the Father, we in him, and he in us. The dear, protecting mother of our body could not defend us from the great father serpent. The mortal, tangible body that she gave us was delivered into his frightening power. But death was not the end. New life, new birth, new knowledge of existence, so that we live not in this physique only, but in all bodies, all physiques of the world, as the Bodhisattva was given us. That father was himself the womb, the mother of a second birth. This is the meaning of the image of the bisexual god. He is the mystery of the theme of initiation. We are taken from the mother, chewed into fragments, and assimilated to the world-annihilating body of the ogre, for whom all the precious forms and beings are only the courses of a feast. But then, miraculously reborn, we are more than we were. If the god is a tribal, racial, national, or sectarian archetype, we are the warriors of his cause. But if he is a lord of the universe itself, we then go forth as knowers to whom all men are brothers. And in either case, the childhood parent images and ideas of good and evil have been surpassed. We no longer desire and fear. We are what was desired and feared. All the gods, bodhisattvas, and buddhas have been subsumed in us, as in the halo of the mighty holder of the lotus of the world.
Come, therefore, and let us return unto the Lord. For he hath torn, and he will heal us. He hath smitten, and he will bind us up. After 2 days will he revive us. In the third day he will raise us up, and we shall live in his sight. Then shall we know, if we follow on to know the Lord. His going forth is prepared as the morning, and he shall come unto us as the rain, as the latter and former rain unto the earth.
This is the sense of the first wonder of the Bodhisattva, the androgynous character of the presence. Therewith, the two apparently opposite mythological adventures come together, the meeting with the goddess and the atonement with the father. For in the first, the initiate learns that male and female are, as phrased in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, two halves of a split pea. Whereas in the second, the father is found to be antecedent to the division of sex. The pronoun he was a manner of speech, the myth of sonship, a guiding line to be erased. And in both cases, it is found, or rather recollected, that the hero himself is that which he had come to find. The second wonder to be noted in the Bodhisattva myth is its annihilation of the distinction between life and release from life, which is symbolized, as we have observed, in the Bodhisattva's renunciation of nirvana. Briefly, nirvana means the extinguishing of the threefold fire of desire, hostility, and delusion. As the reader will recall, in the legend of the temptation under the Bo tree, the antagonist of the future Buddha was Kamamara, literally desire, hostility, or love and death, the magician of delusion. He was a personification of the threefold fire and of the difficulties of the last test, a final threshold guardian to be passed by the universal hero on his supreme adventure to nirvana.
The verb nirva, Sanskrit, is literally to blow out, not transitively, but as a fire ceases to draw. Deprived of fuel, the fire of life is pacified, i.e., quenched. When the mind has been curbed, one attains to the peace of nirvana, desperation in God. It is by ceasing to feed our fires that the peace is reached, of which it is well said in another tradition that it passeth understanding. The word de-spiration is contrived from a literal Latinization of the Sanskrit nirvana. Nir equals out, forth, outward, out of, out from, away, away from. Vana equals blown. Nirvana equals blown out, gone out, extinguished.
Having subdued within himself to the critical point of the ultimate ember, the threefold fire, which is the moving power of the universe, the Savior beheld reflected, as in a mirror, all around him, the last projected fantasies of his primitive physical will to live like other human beings, the will to live according to the normal motives of desire and hostility, in a delusory ambient of phenomenal causes, ends, and means. He was assailed by the last fury of the disregarded flesh, and this was the moment on which all depended, for from one coal could arise again the whole conflagration. This greatly celebrated legend affords an excellent example of the close relationship maintained in the Orient between myth, psychology, and metaphysics. The vivid personifications prepare the intellect for the doctrine of the interdependence of the inner and the outer worlds. No doubt the reader has been struck by a certain resemblance of this ancient mythological doctrine of the dynamics of the psyche to the teachings of the modern Freudian school. According to the latter, the life wish, eros or libido, corresponding to the Buddhist kama, desire, and the death wish, thanatos or destrudo, which is identical with the Buddhist mara, hostility or death, are the two drives that not only move the individual from within, but also animate for him the surrounding world. Moreover, the unconsciously grounded delusions from which desires and hostilities arise are in both systems dispelled by psychological analysis, Sanskrit viveka, and illumination, Sanskrit vidya. Yet the aims of the two teachings, the traditional and the modern, are not exactly the same. Psychoanalysis is a technique to cure excessively suffering individuals of the unconsciously misdirected desires and hostilities that weave around them their private webs of unreal terrors and ambivalent attractions. The patient, released from these, finds himself able to participate with comparative satisfaction in the more realistic fears, hostilities, erotic and religious practices, business enterprises, wars, pastimes, and household tasks offered to him by his particular culture. But for the one who has deliberately undertaken the difficult and dangerous journey beyond the village compound, these interests, too, are to be regarded as based on error. Therefore, the aim of the religious teaching is not to cure the individual back again to the general delusion, but to detach him from delusion altogether. And this not by readjusting the desire, eros, and hostility, thanatos, for that would only originate a new context of delusion, but by extinguishing the impulses to the very root, according to the method of the celebrated Buddhist Eightfold Path.
Right belief, right intentions, right speech, right actions, right livelihood, right endeavoring, right mindfulness, right concentration.
With the final extirpation of delusion, desire, and hostility, nirvana, the mind knows that it is not what it thought. Thought goes. The mind rests in its true state. And here it may dwell until the body drops away.
Stars, darkness, a lamp, a phantom, dew, a bubble, a dream, a flash of lightning, and a cloud. Thus we should look upon all that was made.
The Bodhisattva, however, does not abandon life. Turning his regard from the inner sphere of thought transcending truth, which can be described only as emptiness since it surpasses speech, outward again to the phenomenal world, he perceives without the same ocean of being that he found within. Form is emptiness. Emptiness indeed is form. Emptiness is not different from form. Form is not different from emptiness. What is form? That is emptiness. What is emptiness? That is form. And the same applies to perception, name, conception, and knowledge. Having surpassed the delusions of his formerly self-assertive, self-defensive, self-concerned ego, he knows without and within the same repose. What he beholds without is the visual aspect of the magnitudinous, thought-transcending emptiness on which his own experiences of ego, form, perceptions, speech, conceptions, and knowledge ride. And he is filled with compassion for the self-terrorized beings who live in fright of their own nightmare. He rises, returns to them, and dwells with them as an egoless center, through whom the principle of emptiness is made manifest in its own simplicity. And this is his great compassionate act, for by it the truth is revealed that in the understanding of one in whom the threefold fire of desire, hostility, and delusion is dead, this world is nirvana. Gift waves go out from such a one for the liberation of us all. This, our worldly life, is an activity of nirvana itself. Not the slightest distinction exists between them. And so it may be said that the modern therapeutic goal of the cure back to life is attained through the ancient religious discipline after all. Only the circle traveled by the Bodhisattva is a large one, and the departure from the world is regarded not as a fault, but as the first step into that noble path, at the remotest turn of which illumination is to be won concerning the deep emptiness of the universal round. Such an ideal is well known also to Hinduism. The one freed in life, Jivan Mukta, desireless, compassionate, and wise, with the heart concentrated by yoga, viewing all things with equal regard, beholds himself in all beings, and all beings in himself. In whatever way he leads his life, that one lives in God. The story is told of a Confucian scholar who besought the 28th Buddhist patriarch, Bodhidharma, to pacify his soul. Bodhidharma retorted, "Produce it and I will pacify it." The Confucian replied, "That is my trouble. I cannot find it." Bodhidharma said, "Your wish is granted." The Confucian understood and departed in peace. Those who know not only that the everlasting lives in them, but that what they and all things really are is the everlasting, dwell in the groves of the wish-fulfilling trees, drink the brew of immortality, and listen everywhere to the unheard music of eternal concord. These are the immortals. The Taoist landscape paintings of China and Japan depict supremely the heavenliness of this terrestrial state. The four benevolent animals, the phoenix, the unicorn, the tortoise, and the dragon, dwell amongst the willow gardens, the bamboos, and the plums, and amid the mists of sacred mountains, close to the honored spheres. Sages with craggy bodies but spirits eternally young meditate among these peaks, or ride curious symbolic animals across immortal tides, or converse delightfully over teacups to the flute of Lan Tsai Ho. The mistress of the earthly paradise of the Chinese immortals is the fairy goddess Shi Huang Mu, the golden mother of the tortoise. She dwells in a palace on the Kunlun Mountain, which is surrounded by fragrant flowers, battlements of jewels, and a garden wall of gold. This is the wall of paradise. We are now inside. Shi Huang Mu is the feminine aspect of the Lord who walks in the garden, who created man in his own image, male and female. She is formed of the pure quintessence of the Western air. Her quests at her periodical Feast of the Peaches, celebrated when the peaches ripen, once in every 6,000 years, are served by the Golden Mother's gracious daughters in bowers and pavilions by the Lake of Gems. Waters play there from a remarkable fountain. Phoenix marrow, dragon liver, and other meats are tasted. The peaches and the wine bestow immortality. Music from invisible instruments is heard, songs that are not from mortal lips, and the dances of the visible damsels are the manifestations of the joy of eternity in time. The tea ceremonies of Japan are conceived in the spirit of the Taoist earthly paradise. The tea room, called the Abode of Fancy, is an ephemeral structure built to enclose a moment of poetic intuition. Called, too, the Abode of Vacancy, it is devoid of ornamentation. Temporarily, it contains a single picture or flower arrangement. The tea house is called the Abode of the Unsymmetrical. The unsymmetrical suggests movement, the purposely unfinished leaves of vacuum into which the imagination of the beholder can pour. The guest approaches by the garden path and must stoop through the low entrance. He makes obeisance to the picture or flower arrangement, to the singing kettle, and takes his place on the floor. The simplest object, framed by the controlled simplicity of the tea house, stands out in mysterious beauty, its silence holding the secret of temporal existence. Each guest is permitted to complete the experience in relation to himself. The members of the company thus contemplate the universe in miniature, and become aware of their hidden fellowship with the immortals. The great tea masters were concerned to make of the divine wonder an experienced moment. Then, out of the tea house, the influence was carried into the home, and out of the home distilled into the nation. During the long and peaceful Tokugawa period, 1603 to 1868, before the arrival of Commodore Perry in 1854, the texture of Japanese life became so imbued with significant formalization that existence to the slightest detail was a conscious expression of eternity, the landscape itself a shrine. Similarly, throughout the Orient, throughout the ancient world, and in the pre-Columbian Americas, society and nature represented to the mind the inexpressible. The plants, rocks, fire, water, all are alive. They watch us and see our needs. They see when we have nothing to protect us, declared an old Apache storyteller, and it is then that they reveal themselves and speak to us. This is what the Buddhist calls the Sermon of the Inanimate. A certain Hindu ascetic who lay down to rest beside the holy Ganges placed his feet up on a Shiva symbol, a lingam yoni, a combined phallus and vulva, symbolizing the union of the god with his spouse. A passing priest observed the man reposing thus and rebuked him. "How can you dare to profane this symbol of God by resting your feet on it?" demanded the priest. The ascetic replied, "Good sir, I am sorry, but will you kindly take my feet and place them where there is no such sacred lingam?" The priest seized the ankles of the ascetic and lifted them to the right, But when he set them down, a phallus sprang from the ground, and they rested as before. He moved them again. Another phallus received them. "Ah, I see," said the priest, humbled, and he made obeisance to the reposing saint and went his way. The third wonder of the Bodhisattva myth is that the first wonder, namely the bisexual form, is symbolical of the second, the identity of eternity and time. For in the language of the divine pictures, the world of time is the great mother womb. The life therein, begotten by the Father, is compounded of her darkness and his light. We are conceived in her and dwell removed from the Father, but when we pass from the womb of time at death, which is our birth to eternity, we are given into his hands. The wise realize, even within this womb, that they have come from and are returning to the Father, while the very wise know that she and he are in substance one. This is the meaning of those Tibetan images of the union of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas with their own feminine aspects that have seemed so indecent to many Christian critics. According to one of the traditional ways of looking at these supports of meditation, the female form, Tibetan Yum, is to be regarded as time, and the male Yab as eternity. The union of the two is productive of the world, in which all things are at once temporal and eternal, created in the image of this self-knowing male-female God. The initiate, through meditation, is led to the recollection of this form of forms, Yab-Yum, within himself. Or, on the other hand, the male figure may be regarded as symbolizing the initiating principle, the method, in which case the female denotes the goal to which initiation leads. But this goal is nirvana, eternity. And so it is that both the male and the female are to be envisioned alternately as time and eternity. That is to say, the two are the same. Each is both, and the dual form, Yab-Yum, is only an effect of illusion, which itself, however, is not different from enlightenment.
An Indian illustration shows the Hindu goddess Kali standing on the prostrate form of the god Shiva, her spouse. What Jung, drawing on the language of alchemy, called the Mysterium Conjunctionis, the mystery of the great union, is a standard motif in myths throughout the world, but particularly in the Orient. The Hindu goddess Kali is frequently shown standing on the prostrate form of the god Shiva, her spouse. She brandishes the sword of death, i.e., spiritual discipline. The blood-dripping human head tells the devotee that he that loseth his life for her sake shall find it. The gestures of fear not and bestowing boons teach that she protects her children, that the pairs of opposites of the universal agony are not what they seem, and that for one centered in eternity, the phantasmagoria of temporal goods and evils is but a reflex of the mind. As the goddess herself, though apparently trampling down the god, is actually his blissful dream. Beneath the goddess of the Island of Jewels, two aspects of the god are represented. The one, face upward, in union with her, is the creative, world-enjoying aspect, but the other, turned away, is the Deus absconditus, the divine essence in and by itself, beyond event and change, inactive, dormant, void, beyond even the wonder of the hermaphroditic mystery.
This is a supreme statement of the great paradox by which the wall of the pairs of opposites is shattered, and the candidate admitted to the vision of the God, who when he created man in his own image, created him male and female. In the male's right hand is held a thunderbolt that is the counterpart of himself, while in his left hand he holds a bell, symbolizing the goddess. The thunderbolt is both the method and eternity, whereas the bell is illumined mind. Its note is the beautiful sound of eternity that is heard by the pure mind throughout creation, and therefore within itself. Precisely the same bell is rung in the Christian Mass at the moment when God, through the power of the words of the consecration, descends into the bread and wine. And the Christian reading of the meaning also is the same, et verbum caro factum est, i.e., the jewel is in the lotus. Om mani padme hum.
The Latin translates as, and the Word was made flesh, verse of the Angelus, celebrating the conception of Jesus in Mary's womb. Compare the Kaushitake Upanishad 1:4, describing the hero who has reached the Brahma world. Just as one driving a chariot looks down upon the two chariot wheels, thus he looks down upon day and night, thus upon good deeds and evil deeds, and upon all the pairs of opposites. This one, devoid of good deeds, devoid of evil deeds, a knower of God, unto very God he goes.
In this section, the following have been equated: the void, the world, eternity, time, nirvana, samsara, truth, illusoriness, enlightenment, compassion, the God, the Goddess, the enemy, the friend, death, birth, the thunderbolt, the bell, the jewel, the lotus, subject, object, yab, yum, yang, yin. In their union duality, we see Tao, Supreme Buddha, Bodhisattva, Jivan Mukta, the Word made flesh. 6. The Ultimate Boon.
When the Prince of the Lonesome Island had remained 6 nights and days on the golden couch with the sleeping queen of Tubba Tintai, the couch resting on wheels of gold and the wheels turning continually, the couch going round and round, never stopping night or day, on the 7th morning he said, "It is time for me now to leave this place." So he came down and filled the 3 bottles with water from the flaming well. In the golden chamber was a table of gold, and on the table a leg of mutton with a loaf of bread. And if all the men of Erin were to eat for a 12-month from the table, the mutton and the bread would be in the same form after the eating as before. The prince sat down, ate his fill of the loaf and the leg of mutton, and left them as he had found them. Then he rose up, took his 3 bottles, put them in his wallet, and was leaving the chamber, when he said to himself, "It would be a shame to go away without leaving something by which the queen may know who was here while she slept." So he wrote a letter, saying that the son of the king of Erin and the queen of the Lonesome Island had spent 6 days and nights in the golden chamber of Tubba Tintai, had taken away 3 bottles of water from the flaming well, and had eaten from the table of gold. Putting his letter under the pillow of the queen, he went out, stood in the open window, sprang on the back of the lean and shaggy little horse, and passed the trees and the river unharmed.
The ease with which the adventure is here accomplished signifies that the hero is a superior man, a born king. Such ease distinguishes numerous fairy tales and all legends of the deeds of incarnate gods. Where the usual hero would face a test, the elect encounters no delaying obstacle and makes no mistake. The well is the world navel, its flaming water the indestructible essence of existence, the bed going round and round being the world axis. The sleeping castle is that ultimate abyss to which the descending consciousness submerges in dream, where the individual life is on the point of dissolving into undifferentiated energy. and it would be death to dissolve, yet death also to lack the fire. The motif, derived from an infantile fantasy of the inexhaustible dish, symbolizing the perpetual life-giving, form-building powers of the universal source, is a fairy tale counterpart of the mythological image of the cornucopian banquet of the gods, the bringing together of the two great symbols of the meeting with the goddess and the fire theft, reveals with simplicity and clarity the status of the anthropomorphic powers in the realm of myth. They are not ends in themselves, but guardians, embodiments, or bestowers of the liquor, the milk, the food, the fire, the grace of indestructible life. Such imagery can be readily interpreted as primarily, even though perhaps not ultimately, psychological. For it is possible to observe, in the earliest phases of the development of the infant, symptoms of a dawning mythology of a state beyond the vicissitudes of time. These appear as reactions to, and spontaneous defenses against, the body destruction fantasies that assail the child when it is deprived of the mother breast. The infant reacts with a temper tantrum, and the fantasy that goes with the temper tantrum is to tear everything out of the mother's body. The child then fears retaliation for these impulses, i.e., that everything will be scooped out of its own insides. Anxieties for the integrity of its body, fantasies of restitution, a silent, deep requirement for indestructibility and protection against the bad forces from within and without, begin to direct the shaping psyche, and these remain as determining factors in the later neurotic and even normal life activities, spiritual efforts, religious beliefs, and ritual practices of the adult. The profession, for example, of the medicine man, this nucleus of all primitive societies, originates on the basis of the infantile body destruction fantasies by means of a series of defense mechanisms. In Australia, a basic conception is that the spirits have removed the intestines of the medicine man and substituted pebbles, quartz crystals, a quantity of rope, and sometimes also a little snake endowed with power.
The first formula is abreaction in fantasy. My inside has already been destroyed. Followed by reaction formation. My inside is not something corruptible and full of feces, but incorruptible, full of quartz crystals. The second is projection. It is not I who am trying to penetrate into the body, but foreign sorcerers who shoot disease substances into people. The third formula is restitution. I am not trying to destroy people's insides. I am healing them. At the same time, however, the original fantasy element of the valuable body contents torn out of the mother returns in the healing technique, to suck, to pull, to rub something out of the patient.
Another image of indestructibility is represented in the folk idea of the spiritual double, an external soul not afflicted by the losses and injuries of the present body, but existing safely in some place removed. "My death," said a certain ogre, "is far from here and hard to find on the wide ocean. In that sea is an island, and on the island there grows a green oak. And beneath the oak is an iron chest, and in the chest is a small basket, and in the basket is a hare, and in the hare is a duck, and in the duck is an egg, and he who finds the egg and breaks it kills me at the same time." Compare the dream of a successful modern businesswoman.
"I was stranded on a desert island. There was a Catholic priest there also. He had been doing something about putting boards from one island to another so people could pass. We passed to another island, and there asked a woman where I'd gone. She replied that I was diving with some divers. Then I went somewhere to the interior of the island, where was a body of beautiful water full of gems and jewels, and the other eye was down there in a diving suit. I stood there looking down and watching myself.
There is a charming Hindu tale of a king's daughter who would marry only the man that found and awakened her double in the land of the lotus of the sun at the bottom of the sea. The initiated Australian, after his marriage, is conducted by his grandfather to a sacred cave, and there shown a small slab of wood inscribed with allegorical designs. This, he is told, is your body. This and you are the same. Do not take it to another place, or you will feel pain. The Manichaeans and the Gnostic Christians of the first centuries A.D. taught that when the soul of the blessed arrives in heaven, it is met by saints and angels bearing its vesture of light, which has been preserved for it. The supreme boon desired for the indestructible body is uninterrupted residence in the paradise of the milk that never fails.
Rejoice ye with Jerusalem, and be glad with her, all ye that love her. Rejoice for joy with her, all ye that mourn for her, that ye may suck and be satisfied with the breasts of her consolations, that ye may milk out and be delighted with the abundance of her glory. For thus saith the Lord, Behold, I will extend peace to her like a river. Then shall ye suck, ye shall be borne upon her sides, and be dandled upon her knees.
Soul and body food, heart's ease, is the gift of all heal, the nipple inexhaustible. Mount Olympus rises to the heavens. Gods and heroes banquet there on ambrosia, from the Greek not, brotos, mortal. In Votan's mountain hall, 432,000 heroes consume the undiminished flesh of Sakrimnir, the cosmic boar, washing it down with the milk that runs from the udders of the she-goat, Hydrun. She feeds on the leaves of Yggdrasil, the world ash. Within the fairy hills of Erin, the deathless Tuatha De Danann consume the self-renewing pigs of Mananan, drinking copiously of Gubni's ale. In Persia, the gods in the mountain garden on Mount Hara Berezaiti drink immortal haoma, distilled from the Gaukarena tree, the tree of life. The Japanese gods drink sake, the Polynesian ave, the Aztec gods drink the blood of men and maids, and the redeemed of Yahweh, in their roof garden, are served the inexhaustible, delicious flesh of the monsters Behemoth, Leviathan, and Ziz, while drinking the liquors of the four sweet rivers of paradise. It is obvious that the infantile fantasies which we all cherish still in the unconscious play continually into myth, fairy tale, and the teachings of the church as symbols of indestructible being. This is helpful, for the mind feels at home with the images and seems to be remembering something already known. But the circumstance is obstructive, too, for the feelings come to rest in the symbols and resist passionately every effort to go beyond. The prodigious gulf between those childishly blissful multitudes who fill the world with piety and the truly free breaks open at the line where the symbols give way and are transcended. O ye, writes Dante, departing from the terrestrial paradise, O ye who in a little bark, desirous to listen, have followed behind my craft, which singing passes on, turn to see again your shores. Put not out upon the deep, for haply, losing me, ye would remain astray. The water which I take was never crossed. Minerva breathes, and Apollo guides me, and nine muses point out to me the bears. Here is the line beyond which thinking does not go, beyond which all feeling is truly dead. Like the last stop on a mountain railroad from which climbers step away, and to which they return, there to converse with those who love mountain air but cannot risk the heights. The ineffable teaching of the beatitude beyond imagination comes to us clothed, necessarily, in figures reminiscent of the imagined beatitude of infancy. Hence the deceptive childishness of the tales. Hence, too, the inadequacy of any merely psychological reading.
In the published psychoanalytical literature, the dream sources of the symbols are analyzed, as well as their latent meanings for the unconscious, and the effects of their operation upon the psyche. But the further fact that great teachers have employed them consciously as metaphors remains unregarded, the tacit assumption being that the great teachers of the past were neurotics, except, of course, a number of the Greeks and Romans, who mistook their uncriticized fantasies for revelation. In the same spirit, the revelations of psychoanalysis are regarded by many laymen to be productions of the salacious mind of Dr. Freud.
The sophistication of the humor of the infantile imagery, when inflected in a skillful mythological rendition of metaphysical doctrine, emerges magnificently in one of the best known of the great myths of the Oriental world, the Hindu account of the primordial battle between the Titans and the gods for the liquor of immortality. An ancient earth being, Kashyapa, the turtle man, had married 13 of the daughters of a still more ancient demiurgic patriarch, Daksha, the lord of virtue. Two of these daughters, Diti and Aditi by name, had given birth respectively to the Titans and the gods. In an unending series of family battles, however, many of these sons of Kashyapa were being slain. But now, the high priest of the Titans, by great austerities and meditations, gained the favor of Shiva, Lord of the Universe. Shiva bestowed on him a charm to revive the dead. This gave to the Titans an advantage which the gods, in the next battle, were quick to perceive. They retired in confusion to consult together and addressed themselves to the high divinities Brahma and Vishnu.
Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva, respectively creator, preserver, and destroyer, constitute a trinity in Hinduism, as three aspects of the operation of the one creative substance. After the 7th century BC, Brahma, declining in importance, became merely the creative agent of Vishnu. Thus, Hinduism today is divided into two main camps, one devoted primarily to the creator-preserver Vishnu, the other to Shiva, the world-destroyer, who unites the soul to the eternal. But these two are ultimately one. In the present myth, it is through their joint operation that the elixir of life is obtained.
They were advised to conclude with their brother enemies a temporary truce, during which the Titans should be induced to help them churn the milky ocean of immortal life for its butter. Amrita, not, Murta, mortal, the nectar of deathlessness. Flattered by the invitation, which they regarded as an admission of their superiority, the Titans were delighted to participate. And so the epochal cooperative adventure at the beginning of the four ages of the world cycle began. Mount Mandara was selected as the churning stick. Vasuki, the king of serpents, consented to become the churning rope with which to twirl it. Vishnu himself, in the form of a tortoise, dove into the milky ocean to support with his back the base of the mountain. The gods laid hold of one end of the serpent after it had been wrapped around the mountain, the Titans the other, and the company then churned for 1,000 years. The first thing to arise from the surface of the sea was a black, poisonous smoke called Kalakuta, Black Summit, namely the highest concentration of the power of death. "Drink me," said Kalakuta, and the operation could not proceed until someone should be found capable of drinking it up. Shiva, sitting aloof and afar, was approached. Magnificently, he relaxed from his position of deeply indrawn meditation and proceeded to the scene of the churning of the milky ocean. Taking the tincture of death in a cup, he swallowed it at a gulp, and by his yoga power, held it in his throat. The throat turned blue. Hence Shiva is addressed as Blue Neck, Nilakantha. The churning now being resumed, presently there began coming up out of the inexhaustible depths precious forms of concentrated power. Apsarasis, nymphs, appeared. Lakshmi, the goddess of fortune. The milk-white horse named Ukashravas, neighing aloud. The pearl of gems, Kostuba, and other objects to the number of 13. Last to appear was the skilled physician of the gods, Dhanvantari, holding in his hand the moon, the cup of the nectar of life. Now began immediately a great battle for possession of the invaluable drink. One of the titans, Rahu, managed to steal a sip, but was beheaded before the liquor passed his throat. His body decayed, but the head remained immortal. And this head now goes pursuing the moon forever through the skies, trying again to seize it. When it succeeds, the cup passes easily through its mouth and out again at its throat. That is why we have eclipses of the moon. But Vishnu, concerned lest the gods should lose the advantage, transformed himself into a beautiful dancing damsel. And while the titans, who were lusty fellows, stood spellbound by the girl's charm, she took up the moon cup of Amrita, teased them with it for a moment, and then suddenly passed it over to the gods. Vishnu immediately again transformed himself into a mighty hero, joined the gods against the titans, and helped drive away the enemy to the crags and dark canyons of the world beneath. The gods now dine on the Amrita forever, in their beautiful palaces on the summit of the central mountain of the world, Mount Sumeru. Humor is the touchstone of the truly mythological, as distinct from the more literal-minded and sentimental theological mood. The gods as icons are not ends in themselves. Their entertaining myths transport the mind and spirit not up to, but past them, into the yonder void. From which perspective, the more heavily freighted theological dogmas then appear to have been only pedagogical lures. Their function, to cart the unadroit intellect away from its concrete clutter of facts and events, to a comparatively rarefied zone, where, as a final boon, all existence, whether heavenly, earthly, or infernal, may at last be seen transmuted into the semblance of a lightly passing, recurrent, mere childhood dream of bliss and fright. From one point of view, all those divinities exist, a Tibetan Lama recently replied to the question of an understanding Occidental visitor. From another, they are not real. This is the orthodox teaching of the ancient Tantras. All of these visualized deities are but symbols representing the various things that occur on the path, as well as a doctrine of the contemporary psychoanalytical schools. And the same meta-theological insight seems to be what is suggested in Dante's final verses, where the illuminated voyager at last is able to lift his courageous eyes beyond the beatific vision of Father, Son, and Holy Ghost to the one eternal light. The gods and goddesses, then, are to be understood as embodiments and custodians of the elixir of imperishable being, but not themselves the ultimate in its primary state. What the hero seeks through his intercourse with them is therefore not finally themselves, but their grace, i.e., the power of their sustaining substance. This miraculous energy substance, and this alone, is the imperishable. The names and forms of the deities, who everywhere embody, dispense, and represent it, come and go.